We're here in the South Bronx at John Matos, a.k.a. Crash, a.k.a. prolific artist extraordinaire, worldwide sensation.
Limited
sensation. studio, yeah. This shit is crazy. So I got like a million questions and I'm probably going to go all over the place. But I read that you started painting at two.
Yeah, actually, yes. I was one of those little kids that you give them a piece of paper and a pencil or a pen, and I would draw, absolutely.
And did you have encouragement from your parents? Did you grow up in a single family, a single mom, a single dad at home, or both your parents with you?
Both my parents were there.
Okay, did you get encouragement from them?
Actually, from my older sister. My older sister was really into fashion designing, and in the early 60s, mid-60s, school teachers would come to the homes. You know, they would come in and do, like, tutoring, which they don't do now. And he happened to be an art teacher, and, he's giving her lessons, and I'm in the playpen in the living room. And, you know, I'm carrying on, like, hey, you know, I want to participate. So give me a piece of paper and a pen. And that's how it happened.
So you're in a playpen in your Pampers and shit, and the teacher comes to visit?
Wait, there were no Pampers then.
They were cloth.
They were the real deal.
Cloth diapers with those big ass pins.
Yes.
I think they discontinued some shits in like 1973.
Yeah, too many piercings.
Now it'd be fine.
Now it works.
Now you can have piercings in your eyes. I also read that you were not formally educated as an artist.
Correct. I was not formally educated.
So I find that interesting, especially, well, here's the other question I have, and we'll tie it all in there. I know a lot of guys who started doing street art or graffiti, and a lot of guys who have become, you know, professional artists mm-hmm. like you and make a living mm-hmm. prefer not to be called or associated necessarily as a graffiti artist.
Correct, right. Well, I mean, you know, there's this whole thing about graffiti and the street art. It's two different forms that one branched off the other. A lot of the street artists are actually college-educated kids. You know, they saw graph and decided to go, like, to Rhode Island School of Design or whatever, and they took a different take on it. And, you know, it's easier to take a stencil and a can of paint and, you know, go around doing these little things all around the city, whereas with us, 10 cans, we do one piece and we're done.
Right. So you're saying that, like, graffiti from its inception back in the late 60s, early 70s was more of a exploration and an evolution. It wasn't really an art form yet.
Well, I mean, the early stuff, you're like the late 60s, early 70s, that, you know, it was still in its infancy. So, and people keep forgetting that graph, the original concept was to be famous. You know, like, look at my piece. It's the best. It's the best. It's the best. So, as it progressed, as it grew, it got fancier and more colorful and more stylized. And the trains, you know, when they started doing all the buffing, was sort of like the decline of it. And then the street artists, you know, the street kids, they took it to a different level. They're still with the fame idea, but now they were able to multiply it, you know, and do more with less.
Replicate a specific image, mm-hmm. like guys like Shepard.
Shepard, right. So it was ingenious.
Right.
And I mean, I like the concept. I love the whole thing of it. And it's, you know, it's very different.
Right. So it was a different form of branding and a different form of mass producing your image,
right,
so that you can become famous that way, as opposed to painting one train and hopefully
right.
not having the MTA
right.
buff it
right.
long enough so people could see it.
Correct. And also the thing about it also, it homogenized, you know, it made it palatable. People, in offices can hang a Shepard Fairey, you know, cause it's whatever it is.
It's more commercially accepted.
Yes, absolutely.
Whereas, graffiti back in the '70s, that was a crime and there was
shredding to your face.
And also there was a lot of negative connotation to it.
Correct.
What do you think about, like, I remember, you know, I'm a native New Yorker and I come to New York and I go back and forth from LA to New York, but I remember the first time I started seeing the floor to wall and ceiling wraparound on the inside of the shuttle going from Grand Central to Times Square. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing, what the fuck is the difference between this mass commercialization of bullshit?
There is no, the difference is that we didn't paint it. That's the big difference. They decided to hire someone and do it.
Right, right.
That's what it is.
Right, because if you look at trains in the 70s, you will notice, you know, tags, mm-hmm. which is completely different than you know, piecing, yeah. writing stuff outside of the trains. But if you look at the inside of the trains, like the shuttle or the number, whatever, number six or whatever, they were completely covered in tags, in black ink.
Correct.
And when I look at that, if I was to step aside and look at it from an arbitrary perspective, it almost looks like the same shit.
Yeah.
You know?
It very much is. I mean, the difference is it's printed and wrapped.
Right.
That's it.
Right. I actually find the commercialization, the printed and wrapped stuff, a little bit more offensive. Because coming from and growing up in New York, you know, I'm always looking at things from a sociological and racial perspective. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And again, you know, if there's money involved and commerce to be made, then it's okay, especially if it's from a legitimate source.
Exactly. So what happens is you go to Macy's. Macy's will be willing to give you $3 million. You know,
the MTA, to design a condom case.
And MTA, you know, and the MTA is, you know, they need money.
Right.
You know, so $3 million, you know, for 1 week and, you know, whatever, and let's do it.
So what do you mean the MTA needs money and Macy's?
The transit authority, they need money. You know, they're busted, they're broke.
They're always needing money here.
Yeah, that's why they did it.
Well, I mean, most people don't know this, but the MTA is not a government agency. It's a privatized agency.
Correct.
And what happens is that they always rely, like states and cities, on the federal government to subsidize their bullshit.
Right.
And the thing is, you know, this is another completely different topic. but it's related in a sense because it's about responsibility.
Correct.
You know, it's about, you know, you get money and you to spend it and to use it wisely, and you should be held accountable.
Yes, that's why the MTA is busy taking all the old trains and dumping them in the ocean to create artificial reefs. What the heck? All that money spent.
Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, man, yeah. All the old trains, what they've done is they've taken them and they dropped them off the Jersey Shore and create artificial reefs.
Wow, all right.
So you're talking about billions in the ocean?
Yeah, but I mean, it's also mismanagement, you know.
Absolutely, that's the big one. Yeah,
you know, it's like I'm reading in this news magazine about how California, for instance, now has a surplus of cash, a fucking surplus. Meanwhile, if you look at the price of gas, you would think about maybe, and I'm talking on my ass when I say this, but let's say 15% of what you're paying is in fucking tax,
like in New York.
Those taxes are used to offset, you know, basically the municipalities need to raise money, and where they're going to raise the money, where they're going to tax, you know, wherever they can the most.
Yep.
Drivers, workers, cigarette smokers here in New York. So wherever they can tax you, they're going to tax you. You know what I mean?
And now they're doing the internet tax.
That's another bill that they're trying to pass. Internet sales tax.
Yeah.
But that's another thing. I mean, I just find it interesting how in the 70s, and I think the buffing system started, what, in the early 80s?
Mid-70s.
Oh, mid-70s they started buffing?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so they got a little bit more fancier as the years went on.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. So I find it interesting that In the 70s and 60s and 80s, when the graffiti movement came about, yes, there's a criminal element to it because you have to trespass, mm-hmm. and a lot of it, you know, most of the kids that were doing it weren't working, so they didn't buy the spray paint.
Well, that was, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if you go to any hardware store right now and you notice that there's the paint can section at Home Depot or wherever, they're all locked.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because, you know, you have to be 18 or over to smell the aerosol. It's because motherfuckers used to steal this shit.
Yeah.
And it goes back to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And right now, I'm 52 years old. I need to show them my license in order to buy the paint.
Here in New York?
Yes, sir.
Really?
Yeah. Doesn't matter who you are, you got to show ID to buy paint.
That's funny.
Yes,
you could be in a walker, you got to show ID?
Yep. You could come with your grandmother and she's like, we need your ID.
Do they register your ID?
No, they just do it. It's by law.
Got it. Back in the West Coast, you don't need ID. If you look old enough, they let you go.
Not here.
They let you go. So at what age about did you take your passion for wanting to express yourself on a grander scale and then started painting on trains and whatnot?
Well, I started doing the walls around my neighborhood about when I was 13, 14.
Walls, murals.
Yeah, right. And then 75 was the first train I did, 1975. So I was 16, 15, 16.
Wow. And how did you, who was your inspiration? I know you mentioned there were a couple of cats in your neighborhood that were established subway art painters. Correct. But like, I mean, there's no formal apprenticeship for this. It's not like you go, I want to do this.
No. The formal apprenticeship, no. You pick it up on the streets, like breakdancing. That's your formal apprenticeship.
so it evolves in a sense or in a way. As an activity that you do to, you know, keep yourselves occupied and out of trouble, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, although it was illegal, it was a form of trying to keep us away from getting, you know, I mean, we grew up in pretty hardcore neighborhoods. So yeah. Every one of us knows more than two or three, you know, junkies, prostitutes.
Just two or three?
Well, I mean, generalize. But, you know, that, you know, so we all know that type of lifestyle that we come from. So graff was the mildest, the easiest.
It was a way to prevent or avoid more serious crimes: robbing, killing, mugging, smoking drugs.
The two easiest things, and graff was easier. You know, you didn't have to like train, you know, 8 hours a day to you know, kick a ball, whatever.
Right. So, I mentioned earlier graffiti artists versus just artists. Mm-hmm. What is the difference? There's
no difference between graffiti artists and artists. It's the same. It just so happens that we work, you know, with a different medium.
So then, why such a negative connotation?
The deal with spray paint is because it's so immediate. People couldn't understand that. Like, you know, I could take a can and just do my name on a corner. And I found that offensive. Mm-hmm. But guarantee that if, you know, I'm walking around with a palette and acrylic, you know, and just do my thing, they wouldn't bother. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the random act of it is what I think was what put people off. And then the fact that everything was stolen. I mean, we used to steal the acrylics and the brushes too, you know, and markers. So it didn't make a difference. But I think it was the random act of it that was offensive.
So then why in the 80s a guy like Keith Haring comes along and starts doing
he got arrested a bunch of times too.
Right. But what I'm about to say comes from a socially accepted form of art. You know, he had gallery showings, and he was more socially accepted within the downtown art scene. And so, again, I look at this these issues kind of like from a sociological, racial.
Well, it was a different type of language. I mean, we were in your face. Here we are. Check us out. These are our names. Keith was in your face, but he had a language all of his own. Mm-hmm. And I mean, a lot of us just, you know, we got along well with him, and we were into it. Mm-hmm. And his language was a lot different. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I still remember that when they did the memorial for him at St. John the Divine, whoever was speaking, you know, he mentioned that Keith was, and he mentioned a bunch of us because it was important to him. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So and it was very important to Keith that he was part of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could see that you guys inspired him. I mean,
absolutely.
I know his, you know, a lot of his history from, you know, Pennsylvania art school to doing all sorts of stuff. He's a very smart guy. Yeah. And I remember being turned on to him.
Sidetrack.
What is that?
A friend of mine's a grave digger.
Oh, wow.
So he says, you can fit in here.
That's funny. So Crash just showed me a picture of a grave and a freshly dug grave. Yeah. So could you buy that if you wanted? Could you, like, hold that, like, on reserve and shit?
Yeah, well, I think he probably has a couple of bodies going in today.
Got it. Oh, wow, that's crazy. That's crazy. Has anybody ever commissioned you to paint a grave marker or a tombstone?
No.
That would be pretty dope, huh?
That would be crazy.
That would be dope. Yeah. That would be fucking dope. I might think of that, except I'm not going to be married. I don't believe in burial. I believe in cremation. Anyway.
I'm going that route, too.
You are? You're going that route?
Yeah, yeah.
Good, good, good. So, anyway, we just went on a completely different side.
Rabbit trail?
Rabbit trail.
Rabbit trail.
That's funny.
A whole different thing.
Well, I mean, it's kind of related, because Keith passed away in the early to mid-90s, right?
It, 1990.
1990?
February 90.
Yeah, yeah. He died of AIDS. God bless Keith. I was a fan of Keith's work. What I was saying was I remember when Keith Haring came about. Of course, no one knew who Keith Haring was.
Correct.
All you saw were the chalk drawings inside of the postered MTA billboards.
Yeah.
So, and it was interesting because you'd be on the train, kind of like what you guys are doing with the big murals on the train. It was like, wow, what is that?
Yeah.
Who is that? And I think, you know, that is the point of art. I think art is supposed to provoke thought and question. I think.
I mean, that's any type of art. I mean, Rosenquist, he was quoted as calling graffiti, was it? A lively bouquet from South America as it rolls by the station. I'm like, that's great.
That's what he called it?
That's what he called it.
So what's your relationship with James Rosenquist?
I think more than anything is the way I paint, you know, his positioning of imagery. It's like taking a collage and just putting it in a blender and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he's absolutely amazing, totally underestimated. Undeservedly.
You think he's underestimated?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you got someone like Warhol. I mean, you know, Warhol's not around anymore. And Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, where the pieces are going through the roof.
Right.
And I think he's very undervalued.
Right, right. Okay, so you're saying undervalued in the commercial art market.
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't even know. First of all, you're an inspiration to me. No, seriously, as an artist, you know, because when I started painting in 2003 or something like that. I mean, like you, as a kid, I used to draw.
Right.
And the reason I asked you about if you had gotten support from your parents was because I don't think I got that type of support.
Latino parents don't do that. You know, they initially think that art is like, you know, bourgeois. It's like, that's not going to pay the bills.
Or
you need to go to school and you need to get a job and become a mechanic or a plumber or whatever.
Right.
It's going to help, you know, put the money in.
Because art is not a career.
Art is not a career, according to them.
Right, you can't make a living, so what's the point?
Exactly.
It's not legitimate. What are you doing with your life?
That's it. It's like being an actor, the same type of thing.
Right.
Parents, you know, Latino parents are like, what? You know, what are you doing? What? You know.
Acting. Why don't you act like you're cleaning your room? Well, that's one of the differences in what I know about success and early success is encouragement and, you know, somebody validating what you do.
Right, yeah.
And validating that, wow, that you have potential.
Validating is a really good word, especially with graph. You know, there are only few. In the very beginning, someone like Charlie Ahern and Jane Dixon, who absolutely considered us peers, which was like, you know, like, wow. I mean, to this day, I say it openly that if it wasn't for Jane Dixon, you wouldn't be around.
Really? How's that?
Well, Jane Dixon approached me. Well, I met Charlie when he was scouting locations for Wild Style.
Right.
I met him with Fat Five Freddy.
Right.
And we met at a place called Fashion Moda.
Right.
Never knew what the place was, and I lived in the neighborhood. So I went to the place. I met him there.
What is Fashion Moda?
Fashion Moda was a nonprofit gallery in the South Bronx that specialized in all types of art. Their whole theory was anything goes. It was very interesting.
Very radical.
Very
radical because you're talking about the South Bronx.
Yes.
Most people don't know about the South Bronx. This is the early 80s, right? Like 82?
No, we're talking about, they opened in 79.
Fashion Moda opened in 79.
Yes.
And when did you become hip to Fashion Moda? When was this
1980 to 81. Well, 1980 because in 81 was when I did the big graffiti show.
At Fashion Moda.
Yes.
Well, it's radical. That's a radical thing. So go continue with Jane Dixon and Charlie and all that.
So you know, Jane was married is married to Charlie, and we met anyway. So she asked me if I would be interested and painting an installation she's doing. She was doing a human maze, where she took cardboard and created a maze, and you had to walk through it to get to the middle. And the middle, she had like a table with cookies and stuff, and you had to try and get yourself out. So it was a big maze. So I painted all the walls and all the cardboard.
Oh, wow.
And that was like my first...
Exposure
to doing something within a space. And when they did the invite, you know, she had me in the invite with my name. Like, wow, check this out. Mm-hmm. So then from there, Stefan Ines, who ran Fashion Motor, approached me about doing a show. I said, sure. But then I didn't want to do a show on me. I had to do a group show. Mm-hmm. And so again, so if it wasn't for Jane, and then, you know, the whole thing I did, and then the thing with Stefan Ines, we wouldn't be talking today.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's very radical, because no one wanted anything to do with the South Bronx, and you know, at that time.
Yeah, especially and right about that time, Carter was leaving office and Reaganomics was making its thing. So it was a huge thing. It was a huge, huge moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Google Fashion Moda, and that's MODA, and Google Stefan Ines. Very important in the in the historical content of street art, because it wasn't just you; it was a lot of guys like Lee,
Keith Haring, John Fechner. Barbara Kruger, Jenny Holzer.
Wow.
John Ahern.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tom Adonis. So we're talking about, you know, a who's who.
But a lot of people don't really know a lot about these guys. John Ahern has been my neighbor for God knows almost 20 years or some shit here in New York City. John Ahern happens to be the twin brother of Charlie Ahern, who happens to be the director of probably the quintessential hip-hop movie encompassing graffiti, breakdancing, and rap music, Wild Style. And so how did you get involved in Wild Stop? Through Jane, obviously?
I was with Charlie, and we were scouting locations. And there's a true story. When Charlie started writing the script, he had told me that the script was originally written about me. It took place in South Bronx. I had an older brother who was in a Vietnam vet, and on and on. So the movie's the same type of thing. Eventually, I was supposed to do the part that Lee did, but I didn't want to do it because I wanted to be involved on Broadway on the Twilight Thought play, which was at the same time.
Oh, right. Where you guys actually painted.
Yeah, live on Broadway.
Live on. You guys painted canvases, the backdrop for Twilight Thought.
Rise up as we painted the canvas, unwind, and go all the way to the top. So at the end of the performance, you'll see our names really large.
Dope.
Yeah, it was very cool. So that was happening at the same time as the movie, and I felt the Broadway play was more important for me.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I did that. And they talked Lee into doing it, so they changed it up a little bit. But the actual storyline is based on me.
Nice. That's very interesting, because you could have been indoctrinated or, you know, etched as the main character of the quintessential hip-hop movie of our generation.
Yeah.
Instead, you chose to do something a little bit more sophisticated.
I guess you could say that, but that wasn't... It was just... I just felt, to me, the Broadway thing was a little more thought-provoking. And it was a little more interesting. To do a movie, thinking is you could do,
anybody could do a movie.
Correct.
I mean, meaning you can do a movie anytime.
Correct.
And you were in our movie, Acts of Worship.
Yes.
Which is awesome. My wife got you. She wanted to get everybody she could to do a part in the movie. And you're a guy on the payphone. And you wind up. I mean, you have a distinguished voice like myself.
Yeah.
So you hear your voice right away. If those that know your voice,
Lord,
I know you.
Yeah. Trust me. Yeah.
I want to go back. I want to go back, and not to dwell on it, but just curious as to the ramification, not the ramifications per se, but like the consequences of having to, how you got your materials to do your murals on the subway so that people can know who you are.
We stole everything. The ramifications of that, there's two ways you can look at it. One, you can see how easy it is to steal stuff and you become a klepto you know, and start stealing stuff left and right, which a lot of guys did.
And forget about painting and just say, fuck it, the stealing shit is better.
Yeah, because you could turn around and I could steal a sheepskin coat from like Herman's Sporting Goods store, go down the block and sell for $50. I'm like, yo, $50 in 1978.
A lot of money.
Yeah. So like, all right, so I could turn around, you know, buy me a couple of Adidas, I'm good. Next week, go out and buy, or go steal a down coat, mm-hmm. sell it. Get me a leather jacket, you know, and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. I mean, we used to, I mean, from Steve's baby, we used to steal steaks.
In the mid-70s. You used to steal steaks from where?
In the mid-70s, steak and coffee became very expensive, almost prohibitive in South Bronx.
Because no one could afford it.
Yeah, it was crazy expensive. So we used to steal steaks and coffee.
And sell them to get money
and
to buy paint.
And go down the block like, yo, coffee for like $1.
That's funny because I did one of my episodes, I think it's episode 2 or 3, was about Tide, how people are stealing Tide to sell. Yeah. Because Tide costs about $20-something for 150-ounce container. Yeah. And it costs about $20-something. And the profit margin for the stores is only like $1 or $2, yeah, believe it or not. Yeah. But it's so sought after and not affordable that, you know.
It's not. It doesn't make sense.
Well, it does make sense. Yeah. It does make sense.
Well, it makes sense in terms of making the money. But does it make sense that you're going to put something so, you know, and then try and sell it on 138th Street?
You mean like steaks and coffee?
Yeah, just like steaks and coffee.
But for instance, you go to Puerto Rico. Right. I don't know when's the last time you went there. Coffee is behind fucking locked cages.
And steak is very expensive because, I mean, a lot of our family aren't, you know, made of money. So when you know, you go to visit your brother and they pull out steak with rice, you're like, that's like a huge honor because it's so expensive.
Right, right. That's a Puerto Rican term, by the way, a Latino term. You're not made of money. My grandmother used to be like, turn that light off. You're not made of money. That shit is hilarious. I don't know anybody who's made of money, Ma.
Yeah, no one is.
That's funny. Yeah. That's funny. But that's, you know, that's a very interesting socioeconomic thing. Whereas, you know, things have to be locked up because as currency, you know, currency isn't just money. Currency is what you can sell.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like
it's a bargaining chip.
Exactly.
That's what currency is, a bargaining chip.
Correct. So, like, if a pound of Bustelo coffee can yield me $2, right?
Correct.
I'll steal a pound of Bustelo coffee because that shit is easy to sell.
Yeah. It's like our big thing was also stealing cheese. The government cheese. Check it out. They used to give out these blocks of cheese that were maybe 18 inches or 2 feet wide.
Right.
And what we used to do, we used to steal it. And go
steal it from the truck or
steal it from where they stored them.
Oh, wow.
And then we used to go to the grocery stores and they would give us $15, $20.
Because they made the sandwiches.
By the time they slice all that cheese, they'll make $200-$300 in a day.
Yo, that's hilarious. Let's get that again. By the time you slice that block of cheese, you'll make $200 or $300. That's a fucking huge piece of cheese.
Well, think about it. What was a quarter pound cheese was what? Like what, $1.50?
I have no idea.
You're talking about 2 foot cheese. Because nobody bought a pound of cheese. Everybody, you know, no one's made the money.
Right.
So, you know, everything was like a quarter pound salami, quarter pound ham, quarter pound cheese.
Also, back then,
there was no Swiss. There was white Americans or yellow American cheese.
Right, right, right. And back then, you pretty much bought what you were going to use.
Correct. There were no leftovers.
Right. You're not going to buy 50 pounds of fucking this, 50 pounds of that, and then, you know, 2 months later, you got to throw it out. Our families were very...
I mean, I know I'm like that to this day. I don't buy a lot of groceries. My wife does because we got kids, but I buy what I'm going to use for the next 2 or 3 days. That's it. And then when it runs out, boom, we got more.
Me too. And I'm a big fan of not throwing away food. I mean, my wife and I go out to eat a lot. And just, you know, the new thing is we've been splitting stuff. Because you can't eat a whole fucking steak. You know what I mean?
Well, I could,
but no, but I'm saying it comes down to she can't eat a whole steak. Yeah. And then I'm going to have to eat her half and mine.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. So, you know,
you
being
split.
And being a little bit more conservative. Because, I mean,
That's being green.
It is being green, and it's being mindful and thoughtful of, you know, resources.
Well, you know, remember they tell us that, you know, this little kids in China starving.
That's what we used to be told. You're not made of money, eat all that because there's somebody who's starving in China.
Yeah. And you know what? We didn't realize it, but kids are very conscious of that today.
Well, they should be.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big fan of just doing my part. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid in Puerto Rico, I was washing my hands. And I have the water running.
Don't do that. Wet your hands, take the soap, turn it off, and then turn it back on when
you're
ready to rinse.
Thank you. And my uncle said, turn that off. You're wasting water.
Yeah, and plus, in Puerto Rico, we didn't pay water in New York until recently. So in Puerto Rico, you have to pay for everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So since that time, exactly what you said. I wet my hands, lather up, you know, turn the water off, lather up. Same thing with a shower. I wet myself, lather up, and then rinse myself off. I know it sounds crazy because some people love to stay in the shower for like hours.
I do 5-minute showers. I'm in. I do what I got to do. As I'm out, and you know, my kids are like, I'm like 5-minute showers, man. Military.
That's hilarious. So now here's the thing. You know, I went back to college. I started college in like 1983, and then I left college in 85. Anyway, I got a Bachelor of Arts in Visual Arts.
Nice.
And I got that over a course of, I don't know, maybe 8-9 years. Absolutely, I got it. But I mean, the reason being was I started college. I didn't know what I wanted to do. It was a community college. Then I got into an electrician's apprenticeship program. I became an electrician. Then I went back to school. I thought I wanted to do labor law. And then that was not what I wanted to do. I wound up taking all of my life experiences within painting and photography and put it into a degree. But what I'm going to get at is there was a big emphasis on art history, you know, to get a degree like that and to be an artist. And I was always of the school of thought that if you want to be an artist, just be an artist. Mm-hmm. But how do you feel about the relationship between an artist and art history?
Well, I think it goes hand in hand. I mean, you know, I don't think you have to be stooped into it, you know, stooped so into it.
Steeped.
Thank you. Because the stoop is when you say that when you play baseball.
But the stoop is when you could be stooped into, too.
Right. when you're steeped into it. I think it's important that you know some of it, because some of it is incredibly important. But I don't think you should be motivated to take so much of it to get a degree. Mm-hmm. What's the point?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah, no, I mean, I don't know. I mean, sorry.
Keith Haring.
He had no historical, other than hieroglyphics.
The only thing you could think of is Dubuffet, maybe, you know, someone like that, you know, and it's like, and that's like, well, you know, but, I mean, because it's, you know, sort of like that linear type of thing. So he's a good example of that, you know, and the pop artists, you know.
Like James Rosenquist, Andy Warhol.
Yeah, what they lean on. Well, a lot of them were like failed abstract expressionists, you know, because that came in. And then all of a sudden they clicked, you know, something clicked in them independently and it just took off.
So, I mean, now looking back, not when you first started painting and taking art as a serious thing, which I want to get to that in a second, because I believe you've always taken art as a serious thing and I want to know at what point. But you have a decent amount of knowledge on art history. I mean, you mentioned James Rosenquist, Rauschenberg. Mm-hmm. I know you implement some of Lichtenstein's techniques in your work. And when I mentioned that you were an inspiration to me as an artist, I mean, I remember seeing your work and I'm like, wow, that's exactly what I want to be doing. I love that. I love the way your letters pop, your colors pop, your images pop. I love the way you can't really see that image 100%, but that it's part of the whole picture. And you know, again, it provokes art. Like, what is that? Is that an R? Is that an I? Is that I supposed to mean this or whatever?
Right.
And I love that. And that's what I love about art in general.
Right.
You know, when I first started going to museums and looking at even, let's say, Rauschenberg, when he first started doing sculptures, I used to say, what the fuck is that? A paper bag with a rope on the floor? How's that art?
Right.
But it's art because it provoked the question of what is that?
Right. I mean, the thing with me, you know, just I self-taught myself all the stuff about art history. I mean, when I saw something like, wow, this is really cool. I mean, we didn't have Google, so I went out and, you know, went to the library and like try to figure out who this person is and learn about it because there's a cemetery. Then like the pop artists, you know, we're 60s kids, so that was part of our walk, you know,
well,
whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I wasn't into the minimalist stuff in the 70s because I was just interested in that. So, you know, you learn all this as you're going through life. You know, it's like you know, you probably have a favorite writer or a favorite poet. I love Robert Frost. I learned that about that because I saw something. Someone like, wow, this is really interesting. Look it up. So, you know, it's if you don't do that, there's an old saying, was it? If you stop learning, you start dying. So it, you know, it's, I think it's a point that you need to broaden yourself, mm-hmm. because if you stay in one spot, then you can't teach the world what you want
to
do.
Right. In other words, you can't be stagnant. And the way to not be stagnant is to constantly evolve. Right. And the only way you can evolve is by learning and opening yourself up to ingesting different things and ideas.
You have to, because that's what humanity is. You know, it's an everything, you know, and I can't sit and just like watch TV. You know, there has to be a point to it.
You mean you don't watch like the world's retarded housewives of Mumbai?
I couldn't even tell you who they are.
Come on, man.
I don't watch American Idol.
Me neither. I've never seen one episode.
The only reason I saw The Voice this season is because we had a friend from our church, this 18-year-old girl that was like, she made the top 16. Mm-hmm. So now we're texting her, yo, you did good, you know. So,
right.
And she's out, so that's it. I don't even care what's on anymore.
Right. No, I'm with you on that.
So and I don't even watch sports because it's, you know, so much of it's corrupted and, you know, you don't know what's going on. So I'm an old movies buff, and, you know, and if something's interesting, I watch it.
Yeah. I'm also an old movies buff.
Yeah.
You turned me on to, was it Burt Lancaster? The movie about him being a priest?
Yeah. Elmer Gantry.
Amazing. That's a good movie. You want to remake that movie.
I want to remake that movie. I spoke to your wife about it.
Why do you want to remake that movie? I love the movie, by the way.
I think it's still...
relative?
A very relative and very important subject matter, because it's putting your trust in something. Putting your faith in something. And
he's an alcoholic. He's a boozer and a user.
Right. And he was a
womanizer.
Yeah, he's a hustler.
He's a hustler.
And that's everybody we know right now. So, you know, I was thinking, man, we could do that movie. And I spoke to John, and he said, yo, if you can make this happen, I'm in it. I'm with it.
John who?
Leguizamo.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, man, we got to that point. I spoke to some people with Smith Barney, and they're ready to back it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but we just couldn't get the right writer.
Actually, that movie can be done for a fairly decent budget. So John Leguizamo, he said he'll do it for $1.5 million. That would be his pay.
I back then.
Doesn't he owe you money for a painting?
Yes, he still. Yes, he does. Yes.
I mean, he owes you money for a painting. You gave him a painting. He never paid you for the painting. The value of that painting has, you know,
quadrupled.
It's gone up about tenfold.
Yeah.
You know.
That's him.
So you went to school with John Leguizamo in Queens?
No, we went to a school downtown, Murray Bertram High School.
Murray Bertram. That high school is no longer in existence, is it?
It's still there.
Awesome. So from the South Bronx or from the Bronx, you went to high school in Lower Manhattan.
Which a person from the South Bronx never does.
Correct.
A kid from the Bronx goes to school in the Bronx, marries a girl from the Bronx, lives in the Bronx, never goes to Brooklyn, rarely travels.
That's keep that shit local.
Yeah, that's a fact.
You married a girl from the Bronx?
Yes, from the projects.
From the projects. And you've been married a long time, huh?
We're going to be 25 years, yeah.
Wow, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a prolific, highly successful artist. You're a highly successful husband. And you.
I don't know about that part, but yeah.
No. You're Puerto Rican and you're married 25 years. That's like a straight up anomaly.
I say this to a friend of mine and he laughs. I said, but 25 years, right? If you're a lifer in jail, don't you get paroled?
Yeah.
Don't they give you a suit and $15?
I'm not sure what they give you anymore, but this is my 20th wedding anniversary year myself.
All right. So you got 5 more years before you get paroled. I'm hoping,
yeah, yeah. You know? Well, I have a theory. Seriously, I have a theory about marriage.
Mm.
People nowadays, they get married and then they get divorced in like a year, two, or five.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And they make the rest of us guys that stick with it look bad.
Correct.
You know what I mean? I think that the government should give us a stipend for every year that you're married, both the man and the woman, right?
Yeah, but them getting divorced is what keeps the law institution, you know, making money.
The divorce law institution.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm saying they should have like
it's the economy. We're not supporting the economy.
But I'm saying they should have like, you know, a married man islands fund. You know, like you get to go on a vacation just the guys.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's called parole.
That's your parole.
I don't even get a watch.
That should be funded by the government though. Like, I mean, you know, you and these fucking people, they get married for like a year or two, like these famous people. I don't even want to mention their names because they're retarded. Yeah. You know, and then that's news. You know what I mean?
72 days, yeah.
72 days, that's news. 72 days, that person should contribute to that to that Married Man Island fund. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I got you.
There should be some sort of a penalty. All right, so penalty. I'm serious. I want to talk about Eric Clapton.
All right.
I've met Eric Clapton. I love Eric Clapton. Anybody who knows of Eric Clapton's music, come on. What's there not to like? The man's a fucking genius. You know what I mean? So I read that you met Eric Clapton, in the 90s or something? Or early 2000?
No, I met him... 1996.
A friend, he was looking to do some sort of collaboration with street art.
Correct. He was actually, he had just finished recording a CD of like street music, beats, all this, you know, weird stuff, with a producer and a collaborator. And he had come to New York to shoot areas for video. And, he had heard about me. He wanted to try and see how he could meet me. So he was in a restaurant with one of his managers, and the conversation came up. My name came up, and it turns out that one of the waitresses. Thank you. Wrong airline here. the waitress was a friend of mine.
Oh wow!
So she said, "Look, I know him. I know how to get in contact with him." So she called me. And she said, "Look, a musician I know wants to contact you. Can I give you a number?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure." So she did, and then she called me back and told me who it was. I'm like, "Yeah, right."
A musician.
Yeah. So then the following morning, he called me.
So at that point, you knew his music. I mean, you're familiar with his music. You're a kid of the 60s.
I was a huge, huge fan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from Cream days and all that?
Cream, yeah, up until, I mean, up to the album that I thought was, like, really amazing was an album called August.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. Man's a genius. He's one of the most amazing guitarists. So anyway, Fender Stratocasters. He commissioned you to do one of his guitars, and since then I googled this, and there was like, I don't know, fucking how many of them? 100?
I did 50 Fender Strats, one of a kinds, and then I did about 25 or 30 Telecasters with matching amps. I mean, then you got all the private commissions, so there's got to be 200 or 300 guitars out there.
Yo, them shits is fucking dope.
Thanks.
Seriously.
Thanks.
I remember seeing the first one, and then I remember it was almost like a catalog of I don't know, like cars that you can get this model. I mean, but yeah, they're fucking gorgeous, and they're obviously all unique, and they all pop. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I also read that you mentioned private commissions, that you basically consult Eric before you go ahead and say yes.
Yeah, I did. In the very beginning. The first guitar I did for him wasn't a commission. It was a practical joke.
Really? How'd that come out?
He's famous for his jokes. So, this had to be a God thing. I was sleeping, woke up one morning, the summer of 98, 99. I woke up, and I just told my wife, you know, I want to paint a guitar for Eric. Just like that. So I didn't know how to do it. So I called some of his friends in London, and her personal assistant gave me his guitar text information. I contacted him, and I told him, you know, I want to do this, but it's got to be totally on the hush-hush. I don't want him to know. So I did the guitar, which was really interesting because I never done one before. I did the guitar. They prepared it. They got it ready, and they put it in a guitar case. And then what they did was, he was in L.A. Recording an album with B.B. King, Writing with the King, that album. Mm. So the guitar case is in the corner of the studio. So he walks in, "Hey guys, you know, what's up?" And he sees a couple of guitar cases. So he asks, "What's going on over here?" And they told him, "Oh, it's a new setup, you know, you want to try it?" So he opened up one case, like, "Oh, this is cool." Then he opened up mine and goes, "What the heck is this?" He opened it, and he called me, like, "Dude, what are you doing?" And, you know, like, gotcha, you know. But it backfired because he really liked it. And he used it for like 2 or 3 straight years. And then he commissioned me to do a guitar, and then... And then it just went on.
And then he put you in contact with Fender.
Well, Fender contacted me when they saw his stuff.
Right. That's amazing. And so what else have you done, like, on a grander scale? Not walls, not canvases, not guitars. Cars, maybe? Toothbrushes?
I've done,
I know you've done luggage for Toomey.
Yeah, the Toomey thing.
I own a piece.
Yeah, the Toomey. Oh, you do?
Yeah, hell yeah.
Poor guy. No, the Toomey thing was kind of cool because... I knew Toomey, not from the luggage, but from the backpacks. So, you know, I when they contacted me, I went online and checked it out. I'm like, okay, it's kind of cool. And they were just releasing the hard cases.
Right.
So that just worked out. Dude, that was just, like, amazing how that worked out. If anything is ever God-given, that is, because that just, like, from the beginning to the end, it just was smooth. There was never an ounce of trouble.
So they called you. They said, we love your work. Would you be interested in designing, using your print as a series of our hard luggage?
Right.
And so did you design that specific image
did,
for that?
I did the painting. Specifically for that. They gave me guidelines. I can't use more than 8 colors.
Because the more colors to silk screen, the more money it costs.
It's difficult. So I did the painting with 8 colors. But unbeknownst to me, spray paint, it varies from dark to light. So, like, if you use a blue, you know, it's the same blue, but when you pull back, you got all that misting.
Right.
So that creates a degree of color.
A different hue of color.
You go from dark to light, even though it's one color. So you got all that to
work. Interesting.
So it came out to, like, something like 75, 80 colors.
So, really?
So they did the 8 colors, but they did a process that they hadn't used before anywhere.
So they kind of, like, adjusted it and evened it.
And I used silver spray paint, and you can't duplicate that.
Yeah.
So they used a gray, but it just worked.
Right. No, they're.
It was great, man. It was great.
So okay, so I know this is your. You had a studio, you had another studio. One of the things I know, and we're gonna wrap this up. I got a few more questions to ask you, but we could talk for fucking hours here. Was that I read somewhere that when you were younger, you didn't have a studio and you painted up in the roof in your building,
correct.
And that every day you got up and you treated it as a job.
Correct. I still do. I get up. Even though I'm going to work at home, I get up, I take a shower, I put on my clothes, and I go downstairs and I work. Not to take it for granted, you know. Mm-hmm.
It's a discipline,
and it's something that I think every, whether you're a musician, a writer, whatever it is, you know, all musicians, they play, you know, even if they're just doodling, they play. Writers, you know, if you're not writing, you're formulating, or you know, but it's always it's always writing. Painting is the same thing. I might not use spray paint every day, but I'll do some ink drawings, maybe some watercolors. I'll do some acrylics, you know. But
every day you're doing something.
There's something because I don't think creativity ends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can go out 3 weeks on holiday,
mm-hmm.
you know, on vacation somewhere on the beach, but you come back and you got all that stuff stolen, mm-hmm. and you're like, boom.
Mm.
So it's. I think as an artist, your life should be a diary.
Mm-hmm. See, I was going to ask you what advice you have for younger artists, but I think that kind of covers it right there.
Yeah, man.
And I was going to ask you about, like, spray painting technique, but I would probably gather that would fall under the same answer that you gave me, practice.
Practice, man. Spray painting is not an easy medium.
Hell fucking no. And you guys actually develop spray caps to make them fatter so that you can fill in more area faster.
Well, in the beginning, we used to... We realized that all these companies had different nozzles, like the ones that we used to love with spray starch, Niagara spray starch. Their nozzle was a wide thing. So when we used to paint with that, you cover like a foot long path of color as opposed to just using the little ones.
So Niagara spray starch, that's fucking not spray paint, but it's spray.
Right.
So
that's nozzle. But then you also had Jafoam. Jafoam was a product that you used to clean ovens. You know, you spray.
Yeah.
So those caps.
Those had a wider spray.
So like,
wow.
You know.
See, look at that shit. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay. So recently you did a wall on Houston Street in Lower Manhattan. We were talking about this earlier. That was Keith Haring's original wall up until what, like 2000 or something?
He did the wall originally in 82, 83.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he repainted it again. And then he did a wall with Days and A1 and Kenny Sharp. There was a whole bunch of guys. And that was in 85, 86. Mm-hmm. And then it went dormant for a while.
What, it was just blank?
It was just blank. People just bombed it. They put stuff on it. It became a sign. For a shop down the street, and then, in about 2000, they started up again, and started getting artists from around the world to do a wall. And when I was approached to the wall, I didn't know this. Charlie Ahern told me this, but I'm the only Graff New Yorker, you know, born and raised in New York, because Keys wasn't.
Right.
The only born and raised in New York artist to do the wall and who also did the subways. No one else had done that wall. No so, subway writer and no original
Native New Yorker, right? Because Keith was born in Pennsylvania,
right? Right.
And the other, I know, Los Jimelos were Brazil,
Brazilian.
A couple other guys.
Shepherds from L.A.,
right?
Fail, they're from the U.K.,
right?
And on, and I could, you know, Aiko is Japanese. I just go on and on and on.
Right, right, right. So, but real quick, I'm going to post a picture of that wall on the Skid Row Studios site. And whoever's interested, you can Google the Houston Street wall there that Crash did. The fucking thing is humongous.
It's big, man.
And you were telling me earlier that you did that in 3 fucking days.
3 days, man. Freezing, too. I was given 5 days to do it. And the Tuesday that the wall was supposed to have been primed, there was a massive storm, rainstorm. So they couldn't do anything Tuesday. Wednesday morning, I was supposed to start. So they started priming the wall Wednesday morning. I got there. The guy was finishing one side, and I was already starting on the other side, you know, outlining. Then Thursday and Friday were really freezing cold. Turns out when I was, you know, when I was looking at the weather to find out in terms of painting Saturday, there was a thunderstorm coming in. So I had to finish the wall Friday. And sure enough, it poured Saturday. And it worked out. It was also St. Patrick's Day. So it would have been crazy to try and get into the city.
Right, right, right. Because it's maddening. Yeah. 50 million
so
drunken
3
people.
3 days. Yeah, 3 days.
You guys got to see that wall. It's fucking unbelievable. It's beautiful. You do a lot of cartoon, comic strip type characters. It's got Popeye in it. I love it. It's got a lot of colors. More than 8. Toomey would never have been able to replicate that shit. So we're going to wrap this up real soon, but I wanted to ask you about 2 major exhibits. One of them is Art in the Streets that happened in Los Angeles, curated by Jeffrey Deutsch.
Right.
And how was that for you? And were you happy about it? Just generally, you know, what were your feelings about that? I saw it. I loved it.
The exhibition that you saw was very different from what they originally planned. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do 30 artists and with different artists representing different parts of the world.
Both East Coast and West Coast or just the world?
The world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they had Os Gêmeos from Brazil. They were interested in having me, Lee and Futura represent the United States and on and on and on and on. And as time went on, it changed. It changed incredibly. Then they started deciding about doing installations, and doing this and doing that. Like, you know, it was a little nuts. Again, you know, I think the catalog was better than the exhibition. I mean, just the way. I mean, for example, they left out Fashimoto, which I don't know how. They only included them in the timeline.
Right, right.
And meanwhile, Fashimoto was
a major, integral part of the evolution of.
I mean, more than Patty Astor, you know, and Fun Gallery.
Right.
Not dissing Patty because I love her to death, but Fashimoto was there before them. So you know that was insane. All the problems with all the guys doing installations, you know, all the problems that came up with that was kind of weird.
Because there were quite a few installations in there. But I think a lot of those were from the West Coast, right?
Yes.
Artists from the West Coast?
Well, I mean, even the guy that did the Blade piece, he's from the West Coast.
Oh, the Blade, yeah.
I didn't go to the opening because it bothered me that there were a lot of people who should have been in the show and they weren't in the show.
Mm-hmm. You kind of boycotted in a sense?
You could say that. Yeah, you could say that. It's just, you know, there were a lot of people that shouldn't have been in the show.
Right.
So, you know.
When I saw the show, my take on it was I kind of like the historical content. I wasn't aware about the fashion motor, but it makes sense.
Totally, now it makes sense that
we're talking about it. I thought there were some people in there that really didn't contribute that much to the evolution of graffiti. And they not only were they there, but they put a lot of emphasis or they gave them a lot of props. So I was like, I don't know why he's here and like somebody else isn't here. Who should have been there that wasn't there?
Days
had a little small painting in there.
That was an afterthought. Maybe it wasn't asked.
Yeah.
Doves.
I was wondering why Days only had a small little painting there.
Doves.
Doe's Green. These are all East Coast artists. And Days, Chris Days Ellis is your partner. You guys, you've been sharing studio space with Days from the get-go, huh? Right.
He's my baby mama. Yeah, which, we've been sharing studios since about 83. Yeah.
Right. And I'm definitely going to interview Days in depth another time, because I can't interview him in 10 minutes. He's another another crazy fuck, but a totally prolific and amazing artist as well. So Doe's Green, Days, and who else?
Wow. Those are the first two that come to mind.
All right, I don't have to put you on the spot. Yeah, that's cool, too, guys. And then the other thing that kind of pissed me off was the Whitney Museum of Contemporary Art here in New York City did a similar exhibit, but it wasn't about street art. It was A Century of Art, if I remember correctly, was the title of it.
Wow, yeah, right. And
not one of you guys were included in that.
No, actually, that was the Museum of Art and Art. And the only way...
No, I'm talking about... Whitney, the Whitney.
That's the one that they had Henry's photos. That's the only
They had Keith Haring, and they had Henry Chalfant, yeah.
Right. And then to appease us, they decided to do a thing downstairs.
I didn't even see that.
Yeah, it was a lecture. A lecture? Yeah, a talk.
Oh, a lecture. Yeah.
And a whole bunch of us were there talking. That's what they decided to do.
Yeah, I thought maybe they would incorporate graffiti with Marcel Duchamp and have you guys paint the urinal.
I'm 17. That was how he signed the urinals.
But for me, I was like, whoa, A Century of Art. Well, then how come not even one of these fucking guys that have contributed? Nope. I mean, when you talk about art and you're talking about the art movement in general, I mean, you cannot omit... street art, not the graffiti movement of this.
The political issue, you know, is what came about, because remember, the Whitney, Guggenheim, they all get money from the government to help.
They get grants and subsidies.
And we're talking about an art form that was
criminal.
Yeah.
It originated in criminal activity.
Yes.
Which is how we started the interview.
Correct.
Yeah. So I was a little pissed off. On the other end of the spectrum, I'm not a big fan of the Whitney Museum. I think it's a little too stuffy. I mean, museums in general are
Whitney.
Yeah. I've been to it. The only good thing to come out of the Whitney for me in terms of the best exhibit I've ever seen there. There were two: Carol Walker and Keith Haring. The Keith Haring retrospective.
The Basquiat was nice too.
I didn't see the Basquiat there. I saw the Basquiat in L.A. and I did see the Keith Haring there, and I was fucking blown away. And I did see the Keith Haring retrospective in San Francisco. I thought the New York one was way better.
Yeah, you know, it was Carol Walker's amazing too. But
Carol Walker's fucking out of control.
The Basquiat show was hot.
Yeah. The Basquiat show in L.A. was unbelievable. Yeah. I was never a fan of Jean-Michel Basquiat until I saw that. Yeah. I got it.
Yeah, because if you just see two or three, it doesn't make sense. But when you see it, and it becomes like a diary.
Right.
You can read it, and you can see everything he's went through.
Right, you get him.
Yeah, then you're like, whoa.
Right, you're blown away.
Yeah.
So I think that's it. I think I've kept you in one place for a long time. So I want to thank you so much for giving me the opportunity on Nestorius Public Radio to get a little in depth in you and your work and your life.
I appreciate it.
Go see that wall on Houston Street. Google Crash, John Crash Matos, Google Fashion Moda, and we out.